as you saw with a clip at the start from Wolf from Wall Street, which is actually a fantastic film, although it is a bit hard to stomach at bits. I'm going to be looking hopefully at the topic of bribery and corruption, but my talk was titled tonight, "Am I Mad to Believe I Have a Birthright?" The two don't seem to go together, but hopefully I'll get those back together. Okay, so bribery and corruption happens at every level throughout society. It even happens in my house. At a child level, I have Rachel, who's such a lovely wee thing, would do anything for anybody. And they get a pound, they get £5 a week or something each, and to do that they have to make their beds, keep the bedroom tidy, do their chores during the week, and be polite and pleasant, all these things. And so, if one's not behaving herself, instead of taking the money off them, I do what's called a transfer system in our house. So, if Hannah is being bad, her money moves from her to Rachel. So Rachel could be £6.50 up, Hannah would be £3.50 down. That's how it works. So it's to try and get them both to actually behave, and so that they both get £5 each. That's the system. It's bribery and corruption on my behalf, but actually works very well. But if you look at bribery and corruption throughout the world, we had, a few years back, we had the Italian Prime Minister, Sarkozy, or something like that, who was done for all sorts of bribery and corruption throughout him and his government. We've had the FIFA World Cup governing body lately in the last few years. Through every level of that system, there's been corruption, there's been money paid in the other countries to help other countries make sure they secure the World Cup. There's investigations going on between 2004 and 2011, so like that's spanning about 6 or 7 years of corruption in a world-leading organisation. And there's so much going on in that, even to this day, there's been investigations for £10 million worth of corruption and bribery taking place for the South African World Cup 2010. So it goes on in government level, it goes on in high association levels, it goes on in my own house. And it goes on in the banking system. You've got Barclays Bank and other banks that are being done for corruption at different levels, having to pay fines. And I was quite intrigued because I looked up the whole bribery thing because I thought, I wonder, can you actually go to jail for? And I know that you can for some offences, but there is a 2010 Bribery Act which says the crime of bribery is described as occurring when a person offers or gives or promises to give a financial or other advantage to another individual in exchange for improperly performing a relevant function or activity. The offence of being bribed, which is defined as requesting, accepting or agreeing to such accept such an advantage in exchange for improperly performing such a function or activity. And the Act still says that you can go to jail for 10 years for this crime or have an unlimited fine. I was quite horrified that I realised that my daughters could take me and have me done for the crimes of bribery that I'm using in the house. So tonight, picking up on our story, how's this going to come back to our story tonight? Well, I'm going to be reading now, actually, in Genesis 25, 21-34. We're picking up on the story of Abraham. So Abraham and Sarah had the promise that they would have the son. They had the son Isaac. And now we're picking up with Isaac and his story. And Isaac has also had a promise that he also would have children. But we'll go through that in a minute. We'll read from Genesis 21. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Esau. Afterward his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me,
with that same red stew, for I am weary. Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, look, I am about to die, so what is this birthright to me? And Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose and went his way. Then Esau despised his birthright. Maybe the penny's starting to drop a little. So, in our story tonight, it seems quite unbelievable that, as I've just read, that Jacob is about, or Esau is about to sell his birthright for a bowl of stew. It doesn't seem like it could actually happen, as if that would be the sort of thing he would do. So we start off with Isaac's wife, Jacob, Rebecca, was barren. She wasn't going to have any children, just like Sarah, Abraham's wife. Same thing, wasn't going to have any children. But this time we see that it is Isaac that goes before the Lord, and he pleads before the Lord. You can imagine that he's on his knees and he's crying out to the Lord that he wants his wife to have children. He wants the womb to be open. And, you know, it would seem like an impossible situation, but, you know, Isaac was born the same way, that his mother wouldn't have had any children. The Lord opened her womb and thus he was born. And God can take any opportunity, any situation, and he can change that situation. The Lord had said to Abraham that he would be the father of many. And how was it going to falter on the very first step? God hears and God grants our pleas. And God heard what Isaac had asked and he acted. This is the God who had already demonstrated that he would supply the need. For example, whenever Isaac was being offered up by Abraham to God, God provided the ram. God is the God who sees and who answers and who provides. The prayer that Isaac asked was answered. And of course, when you ask God to bless you, sometimes you don't quite expect it to be answered the way you've asked. You know, you ask a specific blessing or a specific thing, God can answer that and sometimes do a little bit more. On this occasion, we discover that Rebecca is having double the joy. She's having twins. They say that a woman, the older she gets, the more chance there is of the egg splitting and having twins. Twins in my family. So let that be a warning to any woman who's considering having babies in their elder years. We're told that the twins struggle within the womb. And this is a sign of things to come, because the two boys would wrestle and struggle against each other in their life, as we will see. And there is a prophecy that is given by God himself, because Sarah, and I think it's wonderful, because whenever Sarah says that she went to inquire of the Lord, you've got this thing in your head that she's able just to go up to this place and just talk to God face to face, as if God's visibly there, and she's just able to say, look, Lord, what's going on? Things aren't too good here in the stomach. But of course, she goes to God the same way that we can pray to God. And there is a prophecy given by God himself. He says this, two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. And of course, with all the prophecies we've looked at, God's word always comes to pass. And sure enough, she has the twins. And then we have the detailed description of the boys. And the odd thing is, the first one comes out, Esau, there is a full description of what he looks like and all that kind of stuff. And all we get about Jacob is that he's holding his heel. So Esau comes out, he's red in colour, he's covered in a big hairy rug, and they called him Esau. I mean, to me, that was just that's what he looks like, that's what we're going to call. The second child to come out is Jacob, and he is holding his brother's heel, and that's what they call him, Jacob, because he's holding the heel. So we look very quickly at the two guys before I go into what I'm trying to say tonight. Esau would grow up to be a skillful hunter, a man of the field, a man's man, if you like. He's the guy that you'd be proud of as a son in these days. A man that could provide food for the table. A man who'd probably have no fear, could just go out after the wild animals, and was doing his bit, providing, taking part, all the things that a good father would say, yep, that's great. So his father appears, we're told, to favour Esau, for the reasons that I've said, but also, and this is the important thing, he is the firstborn son, and therefore he is the heir to the throne. And that's really important as we go through the story, and it's picked up next week. For this reason alone, he should receive the blessing from his father as we go on through the series, and we'll see what happens.
Jacob, on the other hand, was a shepherd who tended and cared for his flock, lived in the tents, we're told. He was probably more meek and more mild. We get the impression that the two brothers are chalk and cheese, which is a bit like anybody's house. If you've got two kids, you'll always find they're totally different characters. My two girls are poles apart. And so they're always at biting at each other, and they're going to argue with each other, and they're going to have difficulties as they go up together. But the thing about Jacob is we get the impression that he's a wee bit smarter. He's a wee bit more cunning than his brother, and he's able to outwit his brother. So just as we read that Jacob loved Esau, in contrast to that, we see that Rebekah loved Jacob. So favoritism is ruling the house of Isaac. And you know, again, just to give you an example, when my two girls are fighting and are bickering, or they want a favour of me, Rachel, Hannah, is always quick to remind me and say, "Daddy, I'm your number one child." And she's right, because she's the firstborn. And then this riles Rachel, and Rachel says, "Yes, but that makes no difference being number one." And she goes, "Well, number one means number one." And I have to say, "Look guys, there's no favouritism here. You're both equal in my eyes." The thing about favouritism is you can never let the other person know that you have a favourite. If you've got a favourite, keep it in your heart. But the interesting point then to note is whenever the two kids are coming out of the room, Jacob is holding on to his brother's heel. Now the thing about twins being born, and again I haven't had the privilege of being at the birth of twins, but one comes out and the other one does not come out straight behind. It's very rare. There's usually a time period or a gap between the birth of twins. But on this occasion we have Jacob coming right out behind his brother. Now here's the thing. The heel down there represents instinctive nature. That's what it represents in Hebrew thought. While the hand indicates willed and planned action. So you've got one of the boys who's got a real instinctive nature, was the hunter and provider and all of that, and then you've got the other boy who is the willed and planned thinker, and he was the hand. His name was Jacob, and the name signifies one who follows at another's heels. So it literally means, if you looked at the English version of this, it would mean that Jacob is that is one who overreached, got the better by cunning off his brother in the room. So in other words, in the room, the struggle was already going on, and he was already trying to get the better of his brother. And of course, that's going to be outplayed tonight. So to be at a person's heel is to be determined, pursuer, and one who will take an overtaking of the other, or throw the other one down. That's a bit of a tongue twister for me. I was looking at this tonight, I was thinking about my Achilles heel, and I was often thinking about the quotation people use, "Oh, that's your Achilles heel." So I looked it up, and the legend of Achilles, a Greek legend, was a hero. He was invulnerable. Nobody could harm him except for one part of his body, which was his heel. Nothing could damage him, wound him, or hurt him. But in a battle, one day one of the guys threw a sword, it hit his heel, and hence he died. Hence it became known as the Achilles heel. And it's become known as the person, a point of a person's weakness. You talk about your Achilles heel. So this would signify that Jacob would eventually rule over his brother, not through brute might, not through being a warrior, not by being aggressive, not by trying to take hold of his brother, but he would do it by thinking it out, by being able to work it out, and being able to, in other words, outplay his brother. But we have to remember that tonight this story is God's plan unfolding. His purposes and his plans, I can't fathom and I can't work it out. Man's mind is not sufficient enough to reason or try to understand the complexities of what is happening and how it's unfolding before us. Because whenever I'm looking at this story, I'm saying, "Lord, if that's the way it is, why didn't you just put Jacob first, let him out, and then we wouldn't have to go through all of this?" And that's how I would think about it. But that's not how God wanted to have this planned out. The evidence that I've put before us so far has shown us very clearly that when Esau comes in from the day of hunting, when he comes in one day, he's been out in the field, he's the hunter, and he's very tired, he's coming in, he's weary, he's coming in through the door, and now you have Jacob, you can imagine him in the wee overall and all, doing the stew. And he's down and making the stew, a lovely smell. And you've got to think, Jacob's been thinking about this for a while. This isn't just, I don't think, by accident. I think Jacob has been premeditating this for a while. Esau comes in and he smells the food. And it's like, wow, I've got to have some of that food. It's like, you come in here today and you smelt that food. All I could think about during that sermon, sorry, Dave, was food. Because you ate some of that Springfield starving. And my other problem is, on a Wednesday night, Granny Anne makes the best stew in town. And Wednesdays in our house is mayhem. Everything that goes on a Wednesday. And I just wait. Wednesday nights, from winter time, from autumn onwards, Granny Anne gets the stew on the go. And it's a really special time. In fact, I would sell my birthright to Granny Anne for a stew. So Esau must have been starving to the point where all sense just went out the window. He just didn't care. He just wanted the stew, and Jacob took that opportunity to bargain stew for his birthright. He was a manipulator here. Crazy stuff happening right now. And when you would, it's so crazy, you would be mad to believe that this could actually happen. Would somebody do this for the action? The answer is yes, Jacob would do it. Esau would do it. Jacob took the opportunity to do what the prophecy had said and had declared, and that he would one day rule over his brother by gaining his birthright. I'll just take a drink. Okay. This, I would suggest, and this is my view, by the way, is bribery and corruption at its very best. Suggesting that a bowl of homemade stew is worth the firstborn's birthright is scandalous. But Esau treated it with contempt. He didn't give two toots about it. He showed no regard for it or for his father. And in doing so, just blasé, treated it for a bowl of stew. Jacob, being the cuter and evidently better thinker, made his brother promise the birthright to him. Not just promise it to him, but the important word is that he sold it to him. Very important, if you look in the Bible, especially when Abraham bought the burial site for his wife, Sarah, he made sure he purchased it. It was bought and sold. You can't just give it or hand it. It has to be a purchased thing. So he sold him the birthright. And the importance of the word sold can never be overlooked here. It didn't just mean that he gave it to him. He bought it. Now you think about this, and I was thinking, this is incredible stuff. Because his birthright was everything. His birthright was the first inheritance. The person to take over when his father died. He was going to be the main man. And he has just sold that to his brother for a bowl of stew. You think it hasn't happened before? You think that history doesn't repeat itself? You think that history hasn't already seen this happen? Now, again, this is my view on this. But in Genesis, at the beginning, we're told that God gave his creation to Adam, his descendants, to care for it. He created all the world, all the trees and all the animals and everything, and he gave it to Adam to rule over. It was, if you want, Adam's birthright. He was given this whole creation to have. But Adam failed, and this trust, and he sold his birthright, if you will. Now, I know I'm using a wee bit of elaborate thinking, you might call it. But in a sense, he sold his birthright when he disobeyed God, and when he ate of the tree of knowledge, when he took the forbidden fruit. He was deceived by Satan when challenged with the bribe of receiving knowledge in return for eating the fruit. The bribery was the fruit, the ability to know God's will, to be like God. That was the bribery. And the corruption was the sin that came and cursed man from that moment onwards. So from the very beginning, Satan used bribery and corruption to destroy man's walk with God. And he is still using the same ploys to this day. Bribery and corruption is throughout our fabric of society. And it's used at every level, like I tried to describe at the start. So what about your birthright today? If you're a Christian, by this I mean someone who believes in Jesus as their Savior, someone who puts their trust in Jesus, someone who worships and praises Him and follows Him, lives their life for Him, then you have a birthright today that cannot be revoked. You have chosen to believe in the resurrection of Jesus, and through this, you've also been given a birthright. You see, we all get a certificate. When I was born, Keith Robert Mooney, in Leicester, I was born and I was given, my mother went to the place and said, yes, that's my son, his is his name. I got a birth certificate. That's the first thing I get. We all get that. Then, when I became born again believer, a believer in Jesus, when I give my life to him, this is my second life, I get another birth certificate in the sense that I get the right to be called a born again believer, the right to be born, we are born of God, the right to become a child of God, and the right to become a joint heir with Jesus. I get a birthright again. I have a second birth certificate. Because we've been joined to God through Jesus, we have a birthright and an inheritance that cannot be sold, that cannot be bargained, that cannot be given up. We have a birthright as sons of God, and Satan cannot buy this, take it from you, and steal it from you, bargain it, manipulate it from you. When you have that birthright with God through Jesus, it can never be removed from you. That is what every Christian believer has tonight. If you're not a Christian tonight, then you have effectively already given Satan the right to buy your birthright, unless you do something to change it. By default, it is like the person who goes to poll, and you've got all the people that are going to poll, and you get the person that doesn't poll, and then the outcome doesn't come the way they think. They say, well, tough luck, you lost your vote because you didn't go and vote. The same applies tonight. Unless you act to change your birthright, then you don't have the same birthright I do. You will not spend eternity with God in heaven. You have already given it up like Esau. You didn't give a toot about it. You just want to live this life. You want to live and drink and have all the food of this life and everything that this life has to offer you. But you're not considering the life that is to come and the life that Jesus offers us, which is a full life and an abundant life. God has given you a way to know him personally tonight. He has given you the opportunity through Jesus to have eternal life, but to have a new birthright. There is no need to trade. There is no need to buy or sell to obtain this. It is offered to you freely, and freely you can accept it. It is a birthright that will never fade, that will never disappear, and that can never be traded. And it is a birthright that you would be mad not to accept and believe in tonight. Let's pray.